just make it go viral. It is one of the biggest cliches in the world of media, and it gets uttered by bosses and executives all around the world. But this week on Download This Show, you are going to meet the people that actually know how to do it.
You've got to deliver on your promise, really, haven't you? Like, if you're saying that something's going to do something, then when people get there, it's actually got to do that. Otherwise, they're going to think, well, I'm not going to click on that again.
They are the creators and sharers that drive so much of the popular web. YouTube, BuzzFeed, and the Australian sites that are punching well and truly above their weight on a global scale.
You really have to have something unique.
They're time poor. They don't want to wait through that. So you really need to get to the point.
Recorded live at Remix Sydney at Carriage Works, my name is Mark Fennell, and welcome to a very special episode of Download This Show. Go! Thank you, Carriage Works. We are at Remix Sydney and we have an amazing panel for you here today. They are the people that drive our internet consumption in a really serious way. Will you please welcome to the stage a man who has 17 facts you won't believe about what Shakira song you are, the editor of BuzzFeed Australia, Simon Creo. Welcome.
Yay.
And he is the man behind some of Australia's most popular homegrown web properties, In the Mix, Faster Louder, Same Same, Junkie, Tim Duggan. Welcome to Download This Show and Remix Sydney.
Thank you very much.
And finally, she is the woman that knows the answers. She knows will it blend, when to leave Britney alone. She knows what did the fox say, and she knows why Charlie really bit his finger. She's the head of content for YouTube, Felicity McVeigh. Welcome.
Thank you.
All right, today we are talking about content, and I want to start with a big question, which is, what's the biggest change you've seen in digital content in the last few years? And I'm going to start with you, Tim.
Sure. So we've been publishing for on the internet for about 14 years. So I was thinking about it this morning. That we've almost
You're
been publishing.
Ancient. By that
it's a long time. It's pre-Facebook. It's pre-Twitter. You used to remember when you used to actually have to try and find it. Bookmark a homepage and kind of go to that, and email was almost the original social media. And over the past year, the reliance on Facebook and the importance of Facebook, I thought it was important 1 year ago, and in the past year, it has just kind of blown me out of the water about how important it is. So we do large youth research studies, and we did research study last year where we asked about 4,000 18 to 29-year-olds where they get more of their news. So we asked them, do you get more of your news from social media or from newspapers or TV? So about a year ago, 51% told us they get more of their news from social media than they do from newspapers or TV. And I thought that was high at the time. We asked them again a couple of months ago, and it was 65%. Mm. So just a huge reliance on Facebook as being almost the only channel of real great significance that we have kind of feeding into our content. And that's a huge difference for us.
There's been a lot of criticism of Facebook in the last few years about them pushing down the results for brand pages. Have you had an experience where you're getting less reach now than you used to?
Yeah, so in about November, December last year, Facebook changed their algorithm. Mark Zuckerberg came out and said that the point of that was they wanted high-quality content to rise to the top. Mm. And for brands, and probably for any cultural institutions here that have Facebook pages, the average reach fell from about 14% to about 6%. From 2012 to 2014. And if you're a brand with a Facebook page of over 500,000 likes, your average reach when you make a post is about 2%. But the flip actually happened for publishers. And I'm interested to hear some of Simon's case as well. But for publishers, luckily, they viewed our content as high-quality content. And our Facebook reach varies from about 40 to 60% of our audience. So compared with 2% for brands, publishers are really rising to the top with that. So luckily that one worked in our favour, but who knows how long it's going to last. Like, there's Upworthy, one of the sites, they've got kind of a saying about the Facebook algorithm, which is that it's like the weather, that it kind of changes all the time, you just dress appropriately and you go about your business. And that's a little bit scary, the fact that one algorithm can kind of change everything for publishers or for brands.
Simon, curious to get your thoughts on that.
Yeah, well, we sort of see Facebook, I think, a little bit like the newsagent. It's kind of replaced the newsagent in that that's the place that everyone gets their news. It's the place that everyone has a gossip and a chat as well. And so it's like what Tim's saying, basically, that you would go into the newsagent one day and they've rearranged up to say everything and you don't know where anything is. So BuzzFeed, for us, definitely Facebook is by far the biggest referrer. It's a kind of issue we have a little bit internally in that we're all very engaged in all social networks. We're very engaged in Tumblr, in Reddit, in Twitter, massively in Twitter. We spend a lot of time on that probably as employees of BuzzFeed. But in actual fact, our audience is completely on Facebook, really, and our referrals are massively on Facebook. So finding that balance between where we source our content and where we think about where we distribute it is really, really important. And certainly, like, we're new in Australia, but we have been established in the States for a couple of years. And we have a very big audience on Facebook in America, which is kind of something that we're hoping to kind of emulate on a smaller scale in Australia. For us, you know, it's so important in terms of how we distribute our content, how we think about how it's being shared on Facebook. We see ourselves really as a sort of social media company. We're a social news and entertainment company, and so for us, really, the most important thing is thinking about how it's going to spread virally, rather than we don't spend too much time thinking about our homepage. We actually think about that our audience is on Facebook, our readership are there. That's how we're going to distribute our content. So it's a really important part of how we think about how we get our stuff out.
I think it's interesting, just going back to your original question about what changes we've seen in the last year. I think for us, we spent a lot of time in the past talking about audiences. In response to all the talk and everything that's been written on the need to really engage with consumers or customers, users, anybody who really interacts with your brand or organisation, in a two-way conversation. And I think everybody acknowledges the need to do this. But what we've really seen over the past year or so is the power of really engaged, passionate fan bases and how they can supercharge your business and drive it forward. So, you know, what's the difference between, you know, in our world, an audience and a fan base? Well, I think it all comes down to passion. An audience is very much about a lean-back experience. You tell them what to watch, whereas a fan base chooses what and when to watch. An audience changes the channel at the end of a show versus a fan base who, you know, comments, shares, curates, creates, comment, and, you know, I think these guys in their businesses are seeing the benefits of that sharing as well.
I think in terms of where you put your video, Facebook is obviously now, they've changed things around, and as you're scrolling through on your phone, the video will play automatically, and therefore, if you've got a piece of content, I think you should be putting it on Facebook probably as a video there. But like what we find is that with YouTube, like we've been building a very big channel with YouTube, a BuzzFeed, and having a lot of success. We've had over 1 billion views on YouTube, and we're working, you know, a lot of videos, we're seeing over 1 million views. It's a much more customizable piece of content that you have. So if you've got another way website, putting that YouTube video on it gives you so much more flexibility than it's quite hard to put that Facebook video anywhere else. It's good on Facebook, so put it on Facebook, but YouTube gives you so much more variety in terms of if you're sharing it on Twitter or if you're sharing it on your own company site or anything like that. So,
Felicity, you brought up an interesting idea about brand loyalty and kind of cultivating your audience. I'm curious, Tim, you've been doing this for 15 years, you said before. What are the principles of building brand loyalty, building a return audience?
Yeah, God.
Small questions.
How long have we got? I think there's two parts of the equation. One part is the product, and the second part is the audience. So in terms of the product, you really have to have something unique that is a gap in the market. So I'll use Junkee as an example. So Junkee is our pop culture website. It was relaunched about 14 months ago. We spent probably about 6 to 12 months really looking at the pop culture space, looking at every competitor, both here, both overseas, because as an Australian website, you no longer just compete with Australian websites, you compete with the world. And we spent a lot of time just trying to figure out, right, where's that gap in the market? What's the point of difference? You know, we've got a thing called a give a shit-ometer, and we like to apply it to all of our websites, which is, if their website didn't exist tomorrow, would anyone give a shit?
Yeah,
and I think it's a really important kind of thing. So the question when we launch a new product is, on the give a shitometer, if this site didn't exist, is anyone actually going to care? So that's the one side. And the second side is the audience. You need to, you know, as Felicity was talking about, the kind of the passionate side. Because with any website, you might have, you know, if you're talking big numbers, you've got 1 million people going to a website. You really kind of want to focus on that small percentage that's going to be your advocates, they're going to be your super sharers, they're going to be, they're the ones actually going to drive your traffic outside of the casual visitors.
And that's really the people that we create our homepage for, really. Those are the people who we want to surface our best content to. We want to make sure that they're seeing it and they're picking up, and then they're the ones who go off and share it on Facebook or Twitter or Reddit. So they're really important.
Simon, there's been a kind of a subtle shift in what BuzzFeed is known for, I've noticed, in the last year, whereas famously BuzzFeed was the home of kind of listicles and cat pictures, obviously. But there's also been a rise of the quiz. recently. I'm curious, what is it about the quiz? What has worked so well? As I joked before, you know, which Shakira song are you? What is it about those that have been so successful?
Well, I think the biggest part of what BuzzFeed does is try to touch people, reach people's kind of things about themselves. So, like, identity is a big driver for us. So the quizzes are about a sense of identity, whether it's where you grew up or how you feel about a particular thing, or, you know, so something that's really, really personal to you, and that, therefore, by the nature of that, it's very shareable. So the quizzes have been around for quite a long time as a format, but they've only really taken off at the start of this year with a couple of quizzes. The first one was which city should you actually live in? And that sort of everyone kind of daydreams about I kind of like it in Sydney, but I really wish I maybe lived in Tokyo or something. And this quiz, just in a few easy questions, gave you a sense of, like, it kind of validates kind of how you feel about yourself. And so it's actually intensely personal. You share it with your friends and they're like, yeah, that's so you are. No, that's not you at all. So, yeah.
Which city were you?
I was Barcelona.
Which city were you? Felicity, which city were you?
I'm not sure. I haven't done a quiz.
Okay. Sam, which city were you?
I actually haven't done a BuzzFeed quiz, and all of my friends have. I'm sorry, Simon.
That's all right.
All of my friends.
He's feeling.
Constantly have. I'm sorry.
You actually bring up a really interesting point, which is there's a great deal of psychology behind what makes the quizzes work, but also, you know, the classic clickbait headline as well. There is a lot of psychology behind that.
I think there's just a lot of psychology relating to, because we are now the distribution platform ourselves, we share so much stuff, and the power of our own personal recommendation is so important for publishers. It's really, you know, like when you anecdotally used to say to somebody, hey, I read this great article in the paper this morning, you should read that. Now you can actually put it on Facebook or Twitter or anywhere else, and you can actually share it. So the fact that you're sharing it to an audience of your friends, whether they're personal friends or business friends, and you're actually making a real statement about yourself. Mm-hmm. So people, like, they want to look smart, they want to look like they're really positive about the world. So I think this idea that you can tell the world something about yourself by what you share, and I think if you're creating a piece of content, you need to think about, like, the motivations for why people would share it. You know, if it's something that is like this wonderful, amazing thing, we try and do stuff that hits people in the gut. And when we look at a piece of content, we have a kind of gut check. So it's like, it's got to move you emotionally in one kind of way. It's got to be like, it makes you LOL or go WTF or OMG, and it's those kind of drivers. Mm-hmm. And
you know, the funny thing, that is actually on his email signature at the bottom. There's a little yellow dots.
Yeah, but if it's a piece of content you shrug, you're never going to share it. You know, there's not a badge for that, because people won't share that kind of stuff. It's those are the things that move people. So, you know, sharing, that's a really big driver for us.
I only share funny content, just, you know, so people know that I'm hilarious.
Just on the topic of clickbait, they almost emotionally manipulate you to try and kind of click on something.
This kid died, but what he did before he died will leave you in tears.
Which we don't know.
Yes, no, but BuzzFeed don't. And we at Junkie have a really big difference between clickable and clickbait.
Yes.
And there actually is. You can make something clickable without emotionally
blackmailing. It sounds like a very fine, fuzzy, movable line.
We spend a lot of, time arguing. The difference is that clickable should have a payoff when you actually get there, and, you know, nothing is going to... A 30-second video on YouTube is not going to change your life. Hmm. So if you kind of, you know, trick people into getting there through something that's actually not going to work, that's clickbait. Whereas making something clickable might just be kind of like playing up something that's the most interesting part of the headline, but it actually has to be true.
You've got to deliver on your promise, really, haven't you? Like, if you're saying that something's going to do something, then when people get there, it's actually got to do that. Otherwise, they're going to think, well, I'm not going to click on that again. Right. I think Upworthy had a very successful at the end of last year, and their audience was growing massively quickly. And I think the algorithmic changes that you talked about on Facebook, they've kind of counted against them a lot. Mm. And I think there was a whole load of kind of sites like Viral Nova and stuff like that, which were basically just trying to tease people beyond that Facebook page into their site and then try to monetize that. And Facebook, certainly part of the changes has been to avoid that. So you really got, if you're promising something with a piece of content, it's really got to deliver when it gets there. You can't oversell it.
That's right.
We've found there's almost been a consumer backlash to that as well.
Yeah.
So Upworthy, not only did Facebook, there's a million Upworthy parody accounts up around them. You know, you won't believe what the next 30 seconds will change your life. But the consumer backlash to it, I think, is one of kind of like the growing changes as well. There's parody accounts around. People are refusing to click on it. Anytime a Junkie we do anything that's, you know, verges into clickbait, we kind of get eaten alive, and that's like a lesson from our audience, and you have to listen to your audience.
Yes. That's right. And YouTube actually changed their algorithm about 12 to 18 months ago as well, to focus on watch time being a combination of views and retention, because we all know that not all views are created equal. And and that was very much to encourage people to be, you know, much more honest and authentic in their titles, to make sure that, you know, people weren't jumping in and then realizing they've come through to something that doesn't deliver on that promise.
So you can actually track how, if people watch right to the end of the video?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, that's one of the great things about all of the analytics that are available to you. You can see if somebody's coming through to your video and then they're checking out straight at the beginning, you know you're doing something wrong. And that's, I think there's a lot of best practices to be derived, particularly for traditional media that might have always put long credits at the beginning of a video, just like a TV show. And of course, people, they're time poor, they don't want to wait through that. So you really need to get to the point pretty quickly, otherwise you're going to see that drop off.
They've had to wait 4 seconds to get rid of the ad before they see the content anyway, haven't they?
They're skippable ads.
She's got to pay for things somehow, right? What is the most exciting thing for you guys in terms of being actually able to make money out of your content, Tim?
Yeah, native advertising. Full stop.
So you got into a bit of trouble for this. Well, trouble's not really the right word. You got note was given to Sound Alliance for this.
By MediaWatch.
By MediaWatch.
Yeah, actually escaped relatively unscathed, which is, there's always a career KPI to get onto MediaWatch, but to do it and to you know, remain with my dignity, I thought was even double KPI. Yeah, native advertising. So it's kind of the buzzword of 2014. If you read any trade marketing magazines, you'll be sick of hearing about it by now. But essentially, it is creating content for brands and then publishing it on websites. So I'll kind of give my quick definition of it.
Yep.
It's a three-part definition. First part is high-quality content. Mm-hmm. So it can't be shit, essentially, and that is what differentiates it from advertorial. Second part is that it needs to be inspired by a brand. And so every brand wants to get something else, something different out of it. And so some of those are quite kind of tangentially inspired, and some are quite literal. And third part needs to be delivered in stream. And this is the part that MediaWatch love, because delivered in stream means it needs to appear on a website or in a TV show and radio in the exact same place where every other piece of content appears. And that's the part where it's that kind of crossing the line a little bit between journalism and advertorial.
So you're saying it's going to appear like an advert appears on a page in a newspaper?
No. So in a newspaper, it needs to appear where the content appears.
Yeah.
And mainly the thinking behind that is people that essentially have learned to tune out for advertising.
Sure. They don't look at the ads in newspapers, but because they're in Facebook, they're going to look at it.
Yeah.
Who do you think does it best, native advertising? In the world, apart from yourself, obviously.
Listen, I think BuzzFeed do a great job. They kind of originated native, I think you call it social advertising.
Yeah.
They originated native advertising. We kind of took the idea and adapted it for the Australian market.
Look at that, you just teed that right up for you. Take it away, Simon.
Well, we deliberately didn't speak to the ABC. We thought we'd probably on that particular segment. But I thought, you know, it was interesting to see the thought process. And I think it's going to take a little bit of time for people to kind of get their heads around what it is. But I think for us, it's about, in BuzzFeed, there's a very clear separation between church and state still. It's like a traditional media company. So our creative department has nothing to do with our editorial department. So our editors don't have anything to do with the advertising. And I think like what our advertising department are trying to do is basically tell the story of a brand or allow the brand to tell their story. But it's not about ramming a product down their throat. So it's not about McDonald's saying, hey, you need to buy this amazing thing with toppings. It's about creating a piece of content about how life is a little bit better with just a little bit extra. Mm. And it's actually like a funny, shareable piece of content. And then the motivations for that are the same way that people want to share. And that's really the driver for us, is that our editorial team has spent several years sort of perfecting the art of what's a piece of shareable content. And the lessons from that are things that advertisers are now trying to use to reach a younger demographic that perhaps aren't reading newspapers, for instance.
For you, Felicity, in terms of monetization, mm-hmm. what are the exciting things you're seeing in terms of being able to make money out of YouTube?
I think, well, there's two things here. One, I mean, I'm still very excited by the potential of ad-supported and the global nature of ad-supported. So I think, you know, a couple of facts that people might not be aware of is the export potential of content outside Australia. So 90% of views on content created inside Australia or uploaded in Australia are actually viewed offshore. So somebody like Rob Nixon, who's a chef based in Western Australia, he gets 15 times the viewership on his content outside Australia versus inside Australia. So there's still just, you know, massive revenue potential. And I scribbled down a couple of notes related to Psy, you know, and his hit song Gangnam Style. And that particular video has over 1.9 billion views and counting. And so it's obviously a staggering number, but I think the legacy of Psy is what's really incredible. So In 2011, before Gangnam Style premiered, the number of views that Korean pop generated was just over 2 billion. Today it's over 7 billion. Before Gangnam Style, 60% of K-pop videos were viewed inside Asia. Today the lion's share of people watching K-pop live outside of Asia, so 91% of them outside of Korea. So I think it's incredible that in a world where just under 80 million people speak Korean and 25 million of those live inside North Korea, which of course has the lowest internet penetration in the world, South Korea was able to develop this phenomenon so powerful that the K-pop industry overall is now worth $5 billion. So you know, there's just massive potential, you know, on the monetization side to start with a platform like YouTube that's ad-supported, which can grow entire industries.
I think the other thing that's really important when we're talking about monetizing content at the moment is that over the past decade, the shift from newspapers to online, you know, was kind of decimated the newspaper industry. And what we're seeing now is a shift from online as a desktop to mobile. And mobile is a huge issue for most publishers because your yield, which is how many ads you can fit onto a mobile screen, is a lot less than you can fit onto a desktop. Where our youth audience, up to 54% of our audience comes to our sites every day on their mobile. Mm. So for us, it's a massive problem. And that is why native advertising was one of the kind of like the panaceas, I think, and a really interesting kind of new development, because a piece of content on a mobile is just as valuable as a piece of content on a desktop. Facebook, just obviously, they have kind of converted from being essentially making the most of their money through desktop through being a real mobile-led company. And one of the folklore stories of how they did that was that Mark Zuckerberg turned off Facebook on the desktop. So for all of the staff. So all the staff kind of came to work and they could no longer access Facebook on their desktop. They had to kind of go through their phone. They had to develop everything through their phone. And it kind of shifted that whole mentality of them being a company that had some ads down the side of your, you know, your PC or your Mac to being ads on a mobile. And I think that's almost what every publisher has to do at the moment.
Is there a difference in the kind of content that works on desktop and the kind of content that works on mobile for you at BuzzFeed, Simon?
Yeah, there definitely is. I mean, I think mobile content is just by nature more personal because you can be private, you know, at work or wherever you're on your desktop, even if you're at home, other people can see what you're looking at. Whereas when it's close in here or you're looking at it in bed or on the train in the morning, you know, it's a much more personal experience. And we've certainly found that in the range of content we do, we have an internal team called Drug Ops and an internal team called Sex Ops, where we create drug and sex-related content, and that content is certainly stuff that is much more shared on mobile than it is. We've found that as mobile penetration goes up, and in America, 70% of our audience most of the time is looking at the site on mobile.
You can tell it's an arts audience because nobody laughed when you said the word penetration. If this were any younger, be more puerile, people. Be more puerile. Sorry.
I think it's very interesting. I mean, we found fascinating things with mobile, actually, that we've been investing over the last sort of 6 months in an investigative team, and we're creating a whole lot of long reads as well, like Buzz Reads is the section on the site. We're creating long kind of magazine-style 10,000-word articles. Mm. For instance, we had this story about buying a house in Detroit for $100, and we found that people, like 60% of the people reading that story were on their mobile, and it was like a 25-minute read. It went on and on and on, and we could see that people spent that much time reading all the way down. So people are, you know, they will read, they will engage in a really deep, immersive piece of long-form content on their phone. They'll scroll down it, maybe they're on the train or something. So.
And that's a really good point, because it's a constant criticism of BuzzFeed that it's just listicles, but it isn't. There are these BuzzRead pieces. How many of those BuzzRead pieces do you generate in Australia, or are they mostly still coming out of the
States? We've just done a few. We've hired one person now, Christine Kennelly, who's going to be working out of Melbourne to do long-form. And you know, by the nature of a magazine journalism, you know, you probably write one of those stories a month, really. And that's the great luxury is that most of our writers are producing a couple of pieces of content a day, but we are also, within the organisation, have the ability to do those longer form things. So.
And what are the areas that you've identified are going to work for long reads for an Australian audience?
Well, they're going to be exclusive, so we're not going to tell you about
you see
that.
Tim's running notes now.
No, I think, like,
be general.
Yeah, we're very interested in identity, as I said, so we're really interested. We've got a team of LGBT writers, and we've really identified in Australia that marriage equality is this massively important issue. Mm-hmm. Some of the Buzz content we've done has been really, really well received and shared like that, so I think there's huge potential for probably looking at that in depth, and like Indigenous affairs is really, really important for us as well.
Yeah,
and I think, you know,
know, we've got common ground in the fact that the government, for where our audience is, the government provides us with a rich repository of information for fun and memes, but also, for, I think, for something deeper as well.
It does. The long form, I think, as an ex-journalist, is probably the most exciting thing about working online at the moment, because it kind of does disprove that theory that it is just about cat lists.
Yeah.
And people...
Quokka lists.
Quokka lists.
So we've published, we launched a long form series called Headliners, and we debuted it with a piece on Lord, and it was, we commissioned a journalist in New Zealand to essentially spend about 6 months with Lord before she became famous. Mm. So we spent time dinner with her family, and it was in the studio when she recorded Royals, and it was this really fascinating piece, and it launched just as Lord hit. I think she was number one in the US kind of like the week we launched, which is very good timing. So we kind of know that, you know, profile pieces work. And then on Junkie, we experimented with long form with a piece on Senator Scott Ludlam. So we were the first kind of people to properly publish his anti-Tony Abbott speech, that infamous speech that ended up getting almost 1 million views on Junkie. And we were like, okay, cool. There's a seed of an idea there. So we sent one of our reporters across to Perth and embedded him with Scott Ludlam's campaign for a week. And it was an 8,000 word opus with, you know, graphs and videos. And the dwell time on that was about 14.8 minutes.
One of the interesting things about Junkie, though, is for a website that started being about popular culture, its political coverage has become very, very strong. When did you identify that that was going to work on Junkie?
Yeah, almost from the start. And it wasn't when we were talking about it. Junkie's four main philosophies are smart, funny, ballsy, and interesting. So every piece of content needs to kind of fit within one of those four, and the ideal piece of content fits within all four of them. And it was when we started doing, like, you know, Tony Abbott is a godsend for content. Now I think Junkie has found part of its niche is that young people do really care about politics and want to kind of engage with it in a funny, smart, funny, ballsy and interesting way.
And Junkie and maybe BuzzFeed in Australia might not have done so well if we'd launched in 2007 when Kevin Rudd had just got in. I think it's an extra in terms of where they are in the cycle.
I don't know. Yeah. Kevin Rudd's pretty parodyable in his own way.
One of our other sites is Same, which is a national gay and lesbian website. It's the largest one in the country, and I always say that as soon as gay marriage is made legal, our traffic's going to fall off a cliff.
I think the exciting thing about people like Junkie and us and Vice is that we're demonstrating that, you know, while traditional media is really struggling, traditional newspapers, obviously there's Fairfax and News are under tremendous amounts of pressure in terms of their business model. I think the appetite for audiences to learn more about the world and to read or watch very deeply about it is still there. But if it's deeper and richer, people will spend time with it, and it will create this legacy and it will live on. And then this, as a cultural organisation, you can create a piece of content that lives on.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, will you please put your hands together for Tim Duggan from Sound Alliance, Felicity McVeigh from YouTube, and Simon Kiar, the editor of BuzzFeed Australia. You guys have been a fantastic audience, and thank you for joining us here at Remix Sydney.